and equipment needed to combat the disease.
Iran has taken giant strides in the health and medical sector over the past two decades. In fact, Iran's medical device market is growing faster than the world average. The country is globally ranked fourth for engineering over 1,000 medical devices to show for it too. Plus, this technological capacity has allowed the country to churn out advanced devices in the medical sector.
Out of the 1,000 active medical device manufacturers, nearly 230 of them are knowledge-based firms. These companies generate some 30% of revenues in the domestic medical device market. That's all based on figures from the Vice Presidential Office for Science and Technology. Going off of data from Iran's Medical Equipment Office of the Ministry of Health, over 2,000 different types of medical devices are domestically produced. All of these meet EU standardization requirements for sales. Also, statistics showed over half of the 500,000 medical devices made globally have Iranian versions, reducing imports by 10%. Iran also exports these items to over 50 countries worldwide, including Russia, Germany, and Italy, among others. The National Medical Device Directorate reported that back in 2018, this market was worth nearly $3 billion. The latest figures have not been made public yet, and this amount is likely much higher this year. The surge in production in this sector is attributed to the hard work of knowledge-based firms and research institutions. Gas powers production, and oil greases the gears of the industry. Without gas and oil, most industries probably wouldn't thrive as they are today. The world consumes around 36 billion barrels of oil per year. Oil and gas are major industries in the energy market and play a significant role in the global economy as the world's primary fuel source. Meanwhile, the process and systems involved in producing and distributing oil and gas are highly complex. They require lots of money and state-of-the-art technology.
Well, it is that part of the show where I should take a break and pass the action over to my very good friend and colleague out there in the field. Take it away.
Metro stations, airports, and stadiums. These are places filled with crowds. So are places such as important military facilities, as well as places such as parliament or embassies. Now, these places are strategic, so their entrance and exits should be observed carefully. In order to do this, some certain equipment are installed in these places. Not only that, this will also facilitate, getting into these places and out of them, provide security. Also, it has an effect on hygiene. So, today we are at a company that produces a sort of equipment that is related to this. Stay with us and let's find out what they have here. Iranian companies used to import these systems from foreign countries in the past. However, this caused some sorts of problem for them. One of them was that whenever their systems needed fixing, it was very costly and time-consuming. Now, this company has provided the ground for long-term services and post-production services for all customers. That includes two-year guarantees for all customers, plus 10-year services for everyone. High quality and reasonable prices. That's the main feature of the products that are manufactured in this company. But why? Well, they can produce equipment with a very lower price compared to foreign models, because this is a knowledge-based company. From software to hardware, every nook and cranny of these machines is produced here in Iran. And this enables them to modify their equipment or to produce them in any way they want. And that's the key to their success. A turnstile gate is one of their products. It's designed to be used in stadiums. This company has developed an application for football fans. So what can they do? They can buy tickets online. Then the application gives them a QR code. So when they want to enter the stadium, they just show their QR code and then they go through this gate. Initially, when they designed this, until this company designed this, no other company had the experience of producing an equipment like this. And football clubs back then were forced to import it from foreign companies, and that was very expensive. So this company just understood the market's need and started designing this equipment at a very lower price, but a quality that can compete with foreign models. Today we have visited the first company to produce access control systems in Iran. Their key to success is high quality plus reasonable prices. That's it. So you might ask why. Well, they can produce these equipment from 0 to 100, from software to hardware, all in all, in Iran. And that's what makes them different from others. And that's what makes them stand out. Thank you for watching the show. This was Bazaar's report from this company. See you next time.
Many thanks for that awesome report. Well, we're almost out of time, but before we go, let's have a quick look at the news and trends in the food and agricultural industry. Agriculture and horticulture are two of the major areas which the Ministry of Science and Technology has dedicated support packages for. And these aid packages have paid off with new innovative services and products offered in 12 agricultural fields. Some of these innovative services include creating online markets for buying and selling products, supplying inputs, and improving agricultural processes. Other technology has been created by knowledge-based companies that are now playing a colourful role in the agricultural value chain. Farmers are going high-tech as dronology is becoming more common in the cultivation of various crops. From crop spraying to gathering data, more and more farmers use drones to manage their plots. These flying machines also apply fertilizers, pollination, and even sow seeds in remote regions. Iran's agriculture ministry is encouraging the use of drones on farms by offering soft loans to farmers to help them pay for nearly 80% of purchasing costs. Well, that's it for today. Don't forget to give us your feedback. And you can also share your thoughts and ideas with us via email. We always enjoy hearing from you. I'm Samson Sees. Sees you in the next Bazaar.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The European Union is poised to launch legal action against Britain after British ministers controversially claimed an emergency loophole allowed them to scrap post-Brexit checks and standards in Northern Ireland. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Rowena Mason and Daniel Buffy. The piece is titled EU Poised to Take Legal Action Against UK Over Northern Ireland Protocol Bill. The European Union is poised to launch legal action against Britain after British ministers controversially claimed an emergency loophole allowed them to scrap post-Brexit checks and standards in Northern Ireland. In a surprising admission, the British government accepted that its new Northern Ireland Protocol Bill would mean it did not meet its obligations under international law. It justified the move under a principle called the Doctrine of Necessity, claiming the protocol was causing peril to society and politics in Northern Ireland because of the threat to the Good Friday Agreement. Prime Minister Boris Johnson insisted the changes in the legislation were relatively trivial measures designed to ease trade disruption between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom, as the bill was published on Monday, 13th of June. But the European Union said it would launch legal action for infringing the Northern Ireland Protocol, and a majority of members of the Northern Ireland Assembly accused Boris Johnson of being the reckless one by destabilising the Good Friday Agreement. Under the new legislation, which is likely to face considerable opposition in Parliament, the government would scrap checks for firms selling goods from Great Britain destined for Northern Ireland, rather than the European Union. Instead, the government envisages the creation of a green lane of fewer checks for those selling goods heading for Northern Ireland, and also a red lane for existing checks for goods destined for European Union countries. It would also allow firms in Great Britain to export to Northern Ireland to choose between meeting EU or UK standards on regulation, which are expected to increasingly diverge. Further measures include bringing Northern Ireland's tax break and spending policies into line with the rest of the United Kingdom, and changing oversight of trade disputes so that they are resolved by independent arbitration rather than the European Court of Justice, a clause pushed by conservative Eurosceptics. Maroš Šefčovič, the European Union's Brexit Commissioner, hit out a damaging move by Britain and threatened to take British ministers to court. He said, as the first step, the Commission will consider continuing the infringement procedure launched against the UK government in March of 2021. We had put this legal action on hold in September of 2021 in the spirit of constructive cooperation to create a space to look for joint solutions. Britain's unilateral action goes directly against that spirit. The European Union will on Wednesday restart legal action against the United Kingdom for the government's failure to carry out checks on agri-foods and launch two new infringement proceedings for not establishing order posts and sharing data with the European Commission. Speaking after the bill was published, Thomas Byrne, Ireland's Minister for European Affairs, told LBC that there undoubtedly will be consequences for Britain. If you run through a traffic light, you'll be punished. If you commit some other breach of law, you'll be punished, he said. There will be consequences for Britain, but we don't want to get into that space. We want this to be worked out between the two sides for the betterment of Northern Ireland. Meanwhile, Annalena Baerbock, Germany's foreign minister, accused Boris Johnson of playing politics with peace in Northern Ireland. Annalena Baerbock, the German foreign minister, tweeted, "We as European Union have put concrete proposals for solutions on the table, with a firm view to citizens and businesses who benefit from the EU single market every day, and the preservation of the Good Friday Agreement. Peace and prosperity on the island of Ireland are not a pawn." Legal experts quickly cast doubt on the government's justification for flouting international law. David Anderson, a crossbench peer, barrister and visiting professor at King's College School of Law, said, "It sounds thin to me, not to say threadbare." While Emily Thornberry, the shadow attorney general, said the argument was complete and utter nonsense. In its legal summary, the government said, "This is a genuinely exceptional situation, and it is only in the challenging, complex and unique circumstances of Northern Ireland that the government has reluctantly decided to introduce legislative measures which, on entry into force, envisage the non-performance of certain obligations. It is the government's position that, in light of the state of necessity, any such non-performance of its obligations contained in the withdrawal agreement and/or the protocol as a result of the planned legislative measures would be justified as a matter of international law." It argued the peril in Northern Ireland was not inherent in the protocol's provisions. The legislation is likely to encounter serious opposition in the House of Commons and in the House of Lords, with doubts over whether Boris Johnson had support for it to pass. Ministers are also likely to come under some pressure for publication of the full legal advice on the move, as well as the impact assessment, which was not published alongside the bill. The legislation has some critics on the Eurosceptic right, as well as some on the One Nation centrist wing of the Tory party. Government sources said they hoped a vote on the bill would take place before Parliament breaks up for the summer recess, but ministers would want to see some progress towards power sharing returning in Northern Ireland first, which the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, has so far been blocking. Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, the DUP leader, did not signal whether his party would return to the Northern Ireland Assembly or give full support for the bill, but said, "The British government is right to act, and we look forward to giving full consideration to this legislation." A majority of members of the Northern Ireland Assembly from Sinn Féin, the SDLP and the Alliance Party wrote to Boris Johnson on Monday, saying they could not support the move because it flies in the face of the express wishes of not just most businesses, but most people in Northern Ireland. The Assembly is due to vote on whether it gives the consent for the operation of the protocol in 2024, 4 years after it came into force. With opposition mounting, there are some doubts among MPs that the legislation will get anywhere. The government has insisted it would still rather find a negotiated solution to fix problems with the Northern Ireland protocol, but Ireland said on Monday that The Foreign Secretary Liz Truss had not engaged in negotiations with the protocol in a meaningful way since February. A phone call on Monday morning between Liz Truss and Simon Coveney, the Irish Foreign Minister, lasted just 12 minutes. A spokesperson for Ireland's Foreign Affairs Department said, Mr. Coveney said publishing legislation that would breach the UK's commitments under international law, the Brexit Withdrawal Agreement and Northern Ireland Protocol, is deeply damaging to relationships on these islands and between the United Kingdom and the European Union.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
China and the U.S. are locked in a growing war of words over the self-ruled island of Taiwan, which Beijing considers as part of its territory. But now, amid simmering tensions between the superpowers, at a security summit in Singapore, Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin accused the Chinese military of provocative and destabilizing activities near Taiwan. During the same event, the Chinese defense minister hit back at the U.S., saying Beijing had no choice but to fight if attempts are made to separate Taiwan from China.
If anyone dares to secede Taiwan from China, we will not hesitate to fight. We will fight at all costs, and we definitely will fight to the very end. This is the only choice for China.
I think it was very clear the exchange that General Wei had with Secretary Austin was quite straightforward as far as we understand. And his speech was also, of course, very sharp in terms of outlining what the Chinese were prepared to do if Taiwan would declare for independence. Now, both of these people laid out their positions on this. But the question is still very unclear how far the United States is willing to go in trying to use Taiwan in their attempt to bring together the countries of Asia as a counter to China.
But China also struck a more pacifying tone, calling for a stable China-U.S. relationship. Wei stated that the China-U.S. relation is at a critical and crucial juncture. He added that Beijing believes a stable Sino-U.S. relation serves the interests of both countries and the rest of the world. The Chinese defense minister also noted that China had achieved impressive progress in the field of nuclear weapons. Wei, however, noted that Beijing will only use them for defending the nation, never starting a nuclear war, nor ever use nuclear weapons first. He pointed out that the ultimate purpose of China's nuclear arsenal is to prevent a nuclear war. The Chinese defense minister slammed Washington's new strategy, stating that it will lead to further tension between the two countries.
The reality we are witnessing is different to U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin's remarks on the Indo-Pacific strategy. The strategy is an attempt to build an exclusive small group in the name of a free and open Indo-Pacific to hijack countries in the region and target one specific country. It's a strategy to create confrontation to contain and encircle others.
Meanwhile, regional countries also seem to be unaligned with Washington's stance, especially in the light of China's direct investment in Pacific Island countries, which it views as important components of its Belt and Road Initiative.
The Chinese have had a very ambitious and very successful program with the Belt and Road Initiative, which has helped to fill the deficit in infrastructure in the Asia Pacific, and this is only beginning now. What the U.S. has to offer is a system of rules in which these countries must abide by, possibly in order to attain increased trade. But they're really not offering anything concrete other than being associated with the United States and a few other countries.
Washington has made no secret about its stance on China. But the new world order and financial order is taking shape already, and the U.S. is left behind. The U.S.'s use of the dollar as a weapon has pushed nations who have been targeted closer together. This includes energy-rich powerhouses like Iran, Russia, and Venezuela. Even Saudi Arabia is changing some of its oil sales to the yuan. Therefore, it now seems that the U.S. is on the losing side of the ongoing rivalry with China, especially considering what many believe to be its failure both militarily and economically. Rising costs in the U.S. have pushed American citizens to the edge with soaring inflation and the government's inability to control the matter so far. According to the Labor Department, the annual inflation rate rose to 8.6% in May, shattering any hope Americans might have had for relief from the skyrocketing inflation. With inflation hitting the highest rate since 1981, rising costs of living has been squeezing households and putting pressure on policymakers to bring the issue under control. In response to the issue, the U.S. Central Bank has since March been raising interest rates, but the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, which has driven up the price of oil and commodities like wheat as it disrupts exports from the two countries, has made tackling the problem more difficult. Polls show a majority of Americans see inflation as the top problem facing the country. Consumer sentiment has plunged and U.S. President Joe Biden's approval ratings have sunk as Republicans criticize him over the issue. But the U.S. government seems to be more concerned about the conflict in Ukraine, where it has so far given away billions of dollars in weaponry.
This definitely hurts the U.S. economy and Americans. The Biden administration's decision not to push for negotiations between Ukraine and Russia is, to many of us, inexplicable. It's irrational. It's certainly causing enormous carnage and tragedy in that region. And in addition, it's hurting the United States. You know, the average American, when we go to the gas pump these days, I live in California, I'm paying well over $6 per gallon. This is extremely difficult for many American families. So the Biden administration, I think, has been very unwise and damaging in the policies that have been pushed by Secretary of State Blinken and by Victoria Nuland, both of whom are basically neoconservatives.
The price of gasoline in the U.S. has also witnessed a record high, averaging more than $5 a gallon for the first time. Meanwhile, Biden's attempts of lowering prices, namely a record release of barrels from U.S. strategic reserves, waivers on rules for producing summer gasoline, and leaning on major OPEC countries to boost output, have so far proven to be ineffective.
Certainly, the Biden administration should have foreseen these extremely damaging and disturbing consequences. I think that perhaps their policies are driven by somehow, perhaps they think that seeming warlike will help them at the elections coming up very soon. The midterm elections in November are of great concern to the administration because Biden's approval rate is extremely low right now. So they're clearly taking actions that they hope will bolster the results of the election in favor of Democrats.
Saudi Arabia and several other OPEC countries have rebuffed requests by the U.S. to boost oil production beyond the gradual amount. This has led to U.S. lawmakers seeking alternatives to the oil cartel to solve their problems. So far, the U.S. Senate has passed a bill called No Oil Producing and Exporting Cartels Act of 2021. The bill, aside from creating complications for oil companies, is intended to protect consumers and businesses from spikes in costs of petroleum. But analysts warn that implementing it could have some dangerous unintended consequences. Many say the move could harm U.S. energy companies more, as OPEC members produce oil much more cheaply than U.S. companies.
The Secretary General of the Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says the resistance would not remain silent in the face of the Israeli regime's efforts to plunder the country's maritime gas resources. Saeed Hassan Nasrallah made the remark on Thursday after a vessel operated by a Greek company arrived at the Karish gas field in Lebanon's territorial waters to extract gas for the occupying regime. Nasrallah noted the enemy does not recognize the international law and resolutions, reminding that it was not the international regulations, but actually pressure, war of attrition, and resistance that forced the occupying enemy to retreat from the southern Lebanon and the Palestinian enclave of the Gaza Strip.
Hezbollah is part of the Lebanese government. They have MPs inside, and they can maybe adopt a resolution inside the parliament and then move forward with maybe attacking the Israeli vessels and, their workers or so on, to push them away from their resources and their land.
Hezbollah chief also said that the U.S. and Israel are seeking to afflict Lebanon with hunger and partition. Nasrallah said the Lebanese companies that have pioneered to extract the maritime area's resources have been threatened by the U.S. and Israel, warning that Washington and Tel Aviv were after shaving off a large part of the resource-rich area. Lebanon and Israel took part in indirect talks to discuss maritime demarcation in 2020. But they stalled after Lebanon demanded a larger area, including part of the Karish gas field, where Israel has given exploration rights to a Greek firm. The talks were supposed to discuss the Lebanese demand for 860 square kilometers of territory in the disputed maritime area, according to a map sent to the United Nations in 2011. However, Lebanon then said the map was based on erroneous calculations and demanded 1,430 square kilometers more further south, including part of Karish. Israel relies heavily on gas and has long been developing a number of illegal offshore gas deposits in the Mediterranean Sea. This is a particularly sensitive issue for Lebanon, which is dealing with fuel shortages amid a worsening economic crisis.
And I'm pretty sure Hezbollah is wise enough to do this with coordination with other political parties inside Lebanon. Hezbollah does not want to control the country and does not want to push the country towards war, but they want to secure their sovereignty, they want to secure their resources, and they want to keep the country a safe country. And Hezbollah has been proven, with all these years, all their sacrifices and their actions. They're a very credible organization inside Lebanon and a political party that has a lot of good allies. And I think that this is a great opportunity, hopefully, to be able to get some more financial support for the Lebanese nation.
Hezbollah says it has the material and military capabilities that enable it to prevent Israel's gas extraction from Karish. The Hezbollah Secretary General has cautioned the Israeli regime against seeking another war on Lebanon, saying the regime's losses would be greater than those of Lebanon in the event of such military confrontation. This is not the first time the regime has sought to encroach on a nation's sovereign territory, but this time, the response it would receive could be unprecedented.
Thank you. The U.S. and its Western allies have pushed ahead with the anti-Iran hysteria at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. The UN nuclear watchdog's 35-nation board of governors overwhelmingly passed a resolution criticizing Iran for failing to explain uranium traces found at three undeclared sites. The resolution rebuked Iran for what it has described as Tehran's failure to answer questions on alleged uranium traces at undeclared sites. It also accuses Iran of insufficient cooperation with the agency. The resolution excludes a recommendation to refer Iran's case to the UN Security Council, a move that would significantly escalate tensions and likely sink the ongoing talks to revive the 2015 agreement. The resolution against Iran is said to have stemmed from information within two quarterly reports on the country's nuclear activities that were circulated amongst board members last week. Iran insisted it had declared all sites which hosted past nuclear activities. The head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, Mohammad Islami, said Iran has no hidden or undocumented nuclear activities or undisclosed sites.
One of the main things to understand here is that the IAEA as an institution is meant to be, exactly as you said, a technical one. But now it is being used as a vehicle for political purposes in order to pressure Iran, in order to continue the maximum pressure campaign that the Trump administration wanted with the support of Israel to isolate Iran.
These fake documents seek to maintain maximum pressure on Iran. The Israeli regime has openly called on the nuclear watchdog to censure Iran's nuclear program. In brazen remarks to the Knesset, the regime's prime minister, Naftali Bennett, said Israel expected the IAEA's board of governors to strongly condemn Iran and make sure it will pay a heavy price.
So what we are seeing now is a campaign led by the United States, by Israel, and by European partners who promised that they would uphold the JCPOA and respect Iran and respect the deal and want to push America back into the deal. They are now turning around at the Board of Governors of the IAEA and pursuing this really regrettable, unfortunate, and downright dishonorable policy.
In response to the IAEA's unconstructive approach, Iranian officials have now decided to remove two surveillance cameras of the International Atomic Energy Agency from one of its nuclear sites.
And Iran now, we know in the news, is saying that they will not, if the IAEA wants to do these kind of actions, Iran will reconsider its relationship with the IAEA. And I think it is well within its right to do so.
Tehran says the two cameras had been installed voluntarily and beyond the safeguard obligations of the IAEA. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, has hit back at the accusations, saying Tehran has given accurate answers to questions posed by the IAEA, but the agency bases its reports on the information provided by the enemies of Iran. Iran had earlier warned against the consequence of the unconstructive move by the US and Europeans to disrupt negotiations to salvage the multilateral deal officially known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Iran has warned that it would give appropriate response to hostile moves.
Israel is the main provocateur of this current situation. The Zionist regime is dedicated to seeing a war with Iran. They see it almost as a holy duty, and it's not only extremely dangerous and reckless, but it shows the rogue nature of the Zionist state and of its backers in Washington.
The resolution comes as a pause in the Vienna process entered its third month. Tehran blames the US and its allies France, Britain and Germany for failing to act constructively during the talks. Under the JCPOA, Iran accepted certain caps on its nuclear program in exchange for the removal of international sanctions. The US, however, unilaterally abandoned the deal in 2018 and reimposed sweeping sanctions despite Tehran's full compliance with its share of obligations.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
A highly embarrassed President Joe Biden, after wrongly claiming that he was committed to helping Latin America and the Caribbean recover from the COVID-19 pandemic, tackle irregular migration and improve living standards, had to sheepishly hear many of his counterparts from the Hispanic world lash at his lies. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan, international staff writer. This article is published under the heading U.S. Isolated on Its Own Turf. Stay tuned for more. Whatever is left of the plummeting U.S. credibility in its own geographical area took a further nosedive at the summit of the America Summit in Los Angeles, when even the attendees at the heavily boycotted gathering blasted Washington for its affront to humanity. A highly embarrassed President Joe Biden, after wrongly claiming that he was committed to helping Latin America and the Caribbean recover from the COVID-19 pandemic, tackle irregular migration and improve living standards, had to sheepishly hear many of his counterparts from the Hispanic world lash at his lies. Biden, who violated the charter of the Summit of the Americas by excluding the leaders of Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela from the week-long gathering, thereby prompting the leaders of Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, Bolivia, El Salvador, and Haiti to boycott the event, found himself isolated on his own home turf. Biden harping on democracy in the Western Hemisphere, despite the U.S. record of
undermining and overthrowing elected governments in Latin America and all over the world, was challenged by Prime Minister John Briceño of Belize, who said, "The future of the Western Hemisphere is a question for all countries of this region, irrespective of their size, their GDP, and system of governance, in order to ensure a sustainable and equitable future. But isn't it inexcusable that all countries of the Americas are not here and the power of the summit dismissed by their absence?" He said the fact that any Latin American country not being invited to the summit of the Americas was incomprehensible, and in particular not inviting Venezuela was unforgivable. Briceño also criticized the decades-long U.S. economic blockade of Cuba. He was followed at the podium by President Alberto Fernandez of Argentina, who lashed out at the U.S. and called for a change in the rules that allowed Biden, as the host of the summit, to decide who was invited to the gathering. Earlier, Mexico's president Andrés Manuel López Obrador had slammed the U.S. for its policy of exclusion, warning Washington that it needed to change its desire to dominate the world. López Obrador, who turned down Biden's invitation to attend the summit because of the U.S. refusal to invite the leaders of Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua, had made it clear there cannot be a summit of Americas if not all of the continent's countries participate. It is to be noted that U.S. officials had spent weeks trying to find a way to entice President López Obrador to the summit in Los Angeles, but failed. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris could not succeed in persuading the leader of Honduras to come, while the leaders of El Salvador and Guatemala declined Biden's invitation. El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, would not even get on the phone despite frequent calls from U.S. Secretary of State Antony J. Blinken. This is indeed humiliation for the U.S. and a personal blow to Biden, who ought to realize that the days when Latin America was viewed as Washington's backyard are over.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei elaborates on six key points of Imam Khomeini's testament. June 4, 2018. The other point that stands out in the Imam's testament is the need for attention towards Cold War and psychological warfare waged by the enemy. Whenever the enemy fails to achieve its goals in practice, it resorts to psychological warfare, to dishearten nations and fill their hearts with despair. Through psychological warfare and intimidation, they try to convince other nations to end their opposition. This can only mean that they have not been able to resist our nation, in particular arenas. The enemy's psychological warfare started in the early days after the revolution, and it has continued to this day. sometimes they said the revolution will not last longer than 2 months. And sometimes they said it will last for only 2 years. It has been 30 years now that our revolution has continued with full strength and has made the Iranian nation increasingly unified, helpful, and dynamic.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Today, they are waging psychological warfare in various ways. They want to convince the Iranian nation and the Iranian youth that they cannot achieve anything without a connection to domineering powers. This is a grave danger that the Imam has drawn our attention towards. The enemy denies the great advances of our nation. The revolution has managed to overcome several obstacles over the past 30 years. When one delves into the history of world revolutions, they realize that there have rarely been as many obstacles in the way of a nation and a revolution as opposed to Iran's revolution. Also, that all other revolutions are normally thwarted by these obstacles and eventually surrender to the enemy, unlike the Iranian nation. Our revolution has been able to proceed and reach great summits in spite of numerous threats, sanctions, antagonistic measures, plots, and obstructionism. The revolution is looking forward to reaching higher summits and it's proceeding vigorously. Enemies yearn to take this motivation away from the Iranian nation.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Reading out the names of fallen British soldiers in Iraq while a man responsible for their deaths and millions more is honored. Only meters away, a protest organized by Stop the War Coalition calling for former Prime Minister Tony Blair's knighthood ceremony to stop.
It's an absolute outrage that someone who lied to the people, lied to Parliament, lied to the Cabinet, took us into an illegal war which led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people and destroyed a country should be given a knighthood. I mean, it's a disgrace.
The biggest of those lies in the so-called Iraq War dossier, a claim that former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed mass murder weapons.
We knew in September 2002 that the dossier amounted to nothing. We were told it proved there were weapons of mass destruction. Everybody serious who looked at that said it didn't prove anything of the sort. Blair was determined to go to war regardless. He was determined whatever the evidence said. So essentially they cooked up the evidence.
In 2016, all the lies were exposed by the so-called Chilcot report that concluded Iraq posed no immediate threat at the time of the 2003 invasion. For Tony Blair, though, who defended his decision to go to war, that has not meant a war crimes tribunal, but the UK's most prestigious knighthood. To anti-war activists, that is a dangerous precedent.
Well, it's trying to make it easier to go to war in future. It's trying to say to politicians, even if you go to war and it's illegal, it's criminal, it's based on lies, it has nothing but devastating impact, you can still be honoured, it'll be forgive and forget.
But forgive and forget they have not. Tony Blair continues to be one of the most detested politicians at home and abroad.
Nearly two decades since the Iraq War, Tony Blair is known by tens of millions here and abroad as a war criminal, despite efforts to reinvent himself as a visionary leader, which is why these protesters say the only court Tony Blair should be attending today is not a royal one. Saeed Burza is up, London.
As people in Afghanistan are facing acute hunger, poverty, and deprivation, Kelly Clements, the Deputy High Commissioner for UN Refugee Agency, and her delegation visited Kabul to address the humanitarian situation.
This is a very important moment for this country and the people of Afghanistan. It is a time where the world's attention has turned to other situations of displacement, other war, other conflicts. But the needs of the Afghan people are incredibly important, and it's one of the reasons why I have come here now to this country to see how we can best support the needs of the Afghan people.
The UNHCR commissioner also stressed the need for providing a safe ground in Afghanistan for Afghan refugees who want to return to their country and for the people to enjoy their rights.
In addition to the 3.5 million internally displaced people, women, children, and men. There are 6 million Afghans outside of Afghanistan that want to see a country at peace, that want to see a country that is stable, that is inclusive, and that looks after the needs of its people.
Meanwhile, the Taliban's acting minister for refugees affairs welcomed the delegation and said that Afghanistan is ready to cooperate with the UN bodies and other charities to assist the Afghan people.
We appreciate the UNHCR's work and programs in Afghanistan. We expect the international community and the UN to separate the humanitarian issues from political ones and continue their life-saving assistance to our country. We are fully ready to cooperate with them in all of their projects across the country.
In Afghanistan, war has subsided, but the impacts of drought, sanctions, and cuts in global aid continue to drive people from their homelands to other provinces and countries. The UN officials' visit to Afghanistan comes as the country faces widespread hunger and displacement. Afghans are calling for solidarity and funding from the international community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The day before France votes in their first-round legislative elections, rallies were held around the country with two objectives. First, the far right is expected to win their greatest number of seats in 36 years.